Researching to make every life an active life. Today we talk to Dr. Ellen Shanley and Dr. Laura Pitcher-Simone. Going from researcher to athletic trainer to physical therapist using research, how these two identified and solved the problem of the length of time that it took to get from an injury on the field through the process of rehabilitation to back on the field, because that's the point, right? They shared the lessons from identifying the problem to the way they solved it and what they took from it. Want to thank ATI for powering these episodes that we recorded with a bunch of colleagues at CSM this year. My two guests here are focused on research and quality improvement for returning to sport, how collaboration between athletic trainers in the field, physical therapists in the clinic, communicating with doctors, can all get athletes back to health and back to sport faster. Because that's the point, right? ATI strives for the best patient outcomes in the profession. To accomplish that, they focus on their mission to elevate the patient-therapist connection. By limiting the number of patients their therapists see each day, they spend more time building patient relationships that have a positive impact that's crucial to their recovery. Find out more at ATIPT.com. Ladies, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Erin, Laura, what's your superhero backstories? I don't ask what people's bios are or tell me about you, but what's your origin story? That's what all good superhero stories are. They're origin stories. Laura, what's your superhero origin story?
In undergrad, I was actually a psychology major.
Okay, we're going to dig into that.
Knew I wanted to be in healthcare, didn't want to go straight into medicine, but loved people, was an athlete, and loved the concept of helping people get back from injury.
Yeah.
And so found physical therapy and went straight in.
And then, Ellen, what's your superhero origin story with this profession?
Really, my superhero is my dad.
Okay.
And he was an amazing athlete, did a bunch of other things, football, baseball, black belt in karate, ran. But he was running one day in a marathon. He noticed that he had some tightness in his chest. And he ended up finding lung cancer when he was really young, had his lung resected, and still got back with the help of physical therapy to being able to run marathons again.
And that made you say, hey, whatever this is that helped, whatever that is, I want to learn it. I want to be able to do it to help others.
I was like, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd love to do that.
All right, so now we know both of your origin stories. Where do these things intersect? How did you guys come to know each other? And then let's talk about the things that you guys have gotten to do so far and will continue to do so far. So where did it sort of begin so we can understand what you're doing now and how it impacts so many?
Our story intersects at a clinic in South Carolina where I was a PT and a researcher kind of pursuing my PhD, and Laura came as a resident there after her undergraduate and graduate work at Duke. So we met there and had a great time treating patients and learning about a lot of things together.
Yeah, and a backstory of that is I actually got to be in the same clinic as a student. I think about it all the time as sort
of student to grad, and now you're working.
Resident.
Got it. Oh, resident.
Where
perfect.
As a student, my clinical affiliation was canceled 2 weeks before I was supposed to be somewhere else, and they took me on. And I think about that all the time as, you know, it brought me to the group.
Kismet luck, yeah.
Wanted to stay there for residency,
yeah.
So pretty pivotal.
But now you do research.
Yes.
But that's not something that you went into it. You mentioned psychology and wanted to be a great clinician, and all of a sudden we're researching something. How did you take that leap? That's not a step everybody takes.
Yeah. So for me as an undergrad, no research experience, mostly focused on just academics and athletics at that point. Once I got to PT school, really was super focused on just my clinical training. There weren't a lot of structured research experiences that I was afforded at the time. So really just focused on becoming an excellent clinician. And when I got down to South Carolina for the residency program, that's when my eyes really opened to what clinical research was, thinking sort of my bias that I had to be in a lab somewhere
right.
Versus watching my mentors collect outcomes on patients. use their data in real time to inform their decisions, and realizing that this was a whole nother area where I could be stimulated and contribute in a different way. Yeah. That's really where my eyes were opened.
Yeah, you saw yourself as being able to be a great clinician while doing research.
Correct. Yep.
So which one would you identify with more? Are you a clinician? You have to pick one. Are you a clinician or a researcher more? Which one do you feel like you are?
I always feel like a clinician.
Okay.
I think the hours of my day right now, maybe I'm not as focused on the interaction with the patient, but that's really the origin of where I felt I developed as a young therapist, where my passion is and really what drives my interest and my goal through my research program.
All right. So now,
you know, Jimmy, I hate to interrupt, but that's the question that Dr. Hawkins always asks people that do research and are clinical.
Okay.
But he asks, are you a clinician researcher or are you a research clinician? And I think almost everyone from that clinic, including the physicians, would tell you that they were a clinician researcher.
Yep.
That's really what drives their passion for research is finding a better way.
Yeah. And that's good. You're coming at it from a particular direction. So all good research starts with a pain point, a question. We're going to talk about some of the stuff that you've been doing and will be doing. What are the big pain points that you guys saw and then decided to try to eventually solve together, and how'd you do it?
For me, the first idea was like, why do I see the same people coming back year after year, right? So what's wrong in the process, or what am I not giving to people such that they're better and they stay better? So what else can we do?
Yeah, and with that, I think another pain point or just question that was always interesting to me was, how do we identify patterns?
Okay.
And then develop systems to tackle those patterns, right? And obviously every patient is an individual, right? So we need to treat the individual, but how do we also identify themes and things that we can implement from a practice standpoint that could help a lot of people, and then open the door to be able to identify what one person may need, if that makes sense.
Okay.
So whether that's based on a diagnosis or based on an impairment or based on a sport or a goal, it's thinking systematically about how to make those changes, while also not forgetting that there is a person behind the presentation.
Right, which is the thing that drives the whole idea.
Right.
So the idea we were talking about before we hit record, honestly, I should just hit record the second I walk up to people, because that's when the great conversations happen, right? Before we turn the cameras on and put the headphones on. But we were talking about the pain point of athletic trainers first being sort of outmanned, right? Just what was the stat you threw me? It was 350-1?
Yeah, 350 athletes to one athletic trainer.
Wow.
Trying to manage all that. And so, you know, that creates a problem or a logjam, actually.
So, all right, so now let's talk about the logjam. Time-wise, when you were talking about injury, originally you were talking about sometimes 30 days from injury. Getting back on the field or return to sport, if you can't even be seen, then that's going to be pushed back. So how did you guys approach this? What did it look like?
Right, so the traditional model, you know, for athletic trainers is if their athlete needs physical therapy, needs some kind of rehab or treatment, they automatically go to the physician first. And so, you know, there are 350 athletes are a lot for a physician to manage as well. And so we looked at what were some of the ways that we could improve access to care, thereby improving and speeding some of the treatment. And so we worked with our PTs, our athletic trainers, and our team physicians to come up with a model that served the athletes better. And so what we were able to do is sort of negotiate, what things can we start on without sending an athlete to you? What do we need your help with to solve the athlete's problems? And it became a really good pathway to speed the athlete's access. We went from, you know, 30 days to about 7 days to get people care.
It's not a little difference. That's a big difference.
It's a big difference. They also went back to sport 2 weeks sooner, which meant they were going back to sport before they would ever see the doctor.
Sure.
In those cases, they went back with really good outcomes, 85% of normal to start the return to play process. People were happier. Our athletic trainers and PTs became closer. The communication was better. And still, we knew we could do more. And so that's where I think we can learn from Laura in some of the research she's doing and what our clinicians can look for and do with their patients as we're speeding.
Well, I don't want to skip a step. How'd you do it? You know, where did you intersect? And I'm going to take a wild guess that the answer is heavily dependent on people and relationships and figuring out how you could interact better. So walk us through how did you make that change? 30 days to 7 is not small.
No, it's not small. And so what we were able to do is get the buy-in from the physicians that we could do this, and then work really hard on establishing relationships and pathways for athletes to get directly to the clinic then. You know, they really, you know, the one athletic trainer couldn't treat all 300 people.
Can't do it.
And, you know, if you think about even the bigger compression, which is they can't treat them during school, so they're only treating in this hour between school getting out and practice starting. Yeah. And so really having some of the PTs come into the athletic training room, having the athletic trainers visit the PT clinic and doing rounds with them really smoothed the process and made that an attainable goal to get people in within 7 days.
And how did the physician partners, how did your colleagues, physician colleagues, take to this? I mean, I don't want to assume because that's dangerous in research. We never do that, right?
Right.
But how is that looked at by them in this process?
I think the physicians were relieved that they got to see the right patients, yeah. The patients they needed to see and needed to be able to provide care to within a really tight time frame. So their access to our physicians went from 30 days down to seven days for the people we really needed to see.
Yeah, it's triage, weeding out, getting the right people in front of the right provider at the right time. You're looking at those three things.
Well,
so where does the researcher brain come in?
Well, I was going to add to that as we go on. I think the key to all that is the trust between the providers, right? And I think one of the things I learned early was you've got to take the time to build that trust.
Sure.
And whether we're talking about referral patterns or, I don't know, just interdisciplinary collaboration, that's really critical. And I think in an academic mindset, right, as we think about developing meaningful projects that really affect the patient, we've got to all be on the same page. And so I think some of the skills I learned as a young clinician totally transfer to how we pursue doing good research, in that all the stakeholders have to be a part of the conversation.
Yep.
If I'm going to propose some clinical trial, it might be the best science ever, but if the clinicians aren't bought in,
yeah,
the patients are never going to be bought in. They're
yep.
never going to enroll in your study, and it's not going to mean anything to the people that need to know the information. So
yeah.
I think that model and capitalizing on the really richness of the trust amongst providers is super important.
What were some findings that came out of it that excited you, surprised you? I always like to ask researchers that. Surprising or enlightening or unexpected, or things that you that passed the eyebrow test that made you kind of go, ooh, that's interesting.
With what?
with any of this process. Yeah,
process.
I mean.
Well, I mean, I guess as I've developed personally, as I've developed as a researcher, some very small projects, some larger collaborative project with different individuals. I think what always has been eye-opening to me, this isn't like one specific research finding on data necessarily, but just the idea that like you've got to be able to present your data and you've got to be able to make it meaningful.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've done studies in different populations, you know, folks after ACL reconstruction, right, where we can think about something very, very subtle or nuancy about their recovery. And that might be really important to a group of clinicians, but unless we can transfer that and make it important to the patient, how does that help us move the needle forward in clinical practice?
Right.
And so I think, you know, we as researchers can get really excited about one small finding.
Yes.
And it might be statistically significant. We might, you know, see changes in the cartilage after some type of intervention, whatever it is, right, that we're thinking about. But unless we can transfer that to be something that's digestible by a patient and that we can act on as physical therapists, that's the next step.
Yeah. Make it meaningful and make sure I can understand it. I'm giving a presentation today to researchers in the Academy of Research. I should not be anywhere near research. I mean, this is as close to research as I should be, as talking to smart people. But I'm presenting on communication strategies, where I'm presenting with a traditional researcher. And I come in from a guy with a degree in journalism and communications and PT, and I say, oh, I can very clearly see why research often has a 17-year gap from publish to practice. It's because when you're done publishing, you sort of just present this here and you say, there it is in all its glory. And I say, make the movie trailer. Make the tweet thread, make the Instagram carousel, make it digestible, but focus on the meaning to the audience. And it might be very different to a patient or a physician or an athletic trainer or a physical therapist. What is interesting to them?
Right. And that's so awesome that that type of presentation exists to bring those groups together. I was just on a meeting this week with some colleagues thinking about identifying barriers to certain types of practice that we're trying to, like more psychologically informed practice. And we talked about this concept of the implementation barriers. Obviously,
right.
Implementation science is a whole field.
Right.
But I think sometimes we get caught up in like the findings and we don't think about how to transfer that back to the clinic, why this collaboration is great.
Right. I think my presentation today, I say something along the lines of, if you have the greatest song that's ever been written and ever recorded, but you never release it,
right.
it doesn't really matter. ATI is a little bit different because you have interprofessional collaboration on your same team. Yep. You have athletic trainers. So there is a relationship that is built. Still need to work on it though, right? Because these are individual people. That's pretty unique, having a practice this large with physical therapists and other providers.
Yeah, it is unique and it has so many benefits.
Like?
So say I'm the clinician in the clinic and I have one of the athletes from the high school coming to see me. The athletic trainer gives me so many tips and so much understanding about who this person is and what they need and what their hopes and dreams are. And that's really important. The context of the person,
huge.
Understanding if they're nervous about something, understanding if they can help direct their own plan and help me create the best plan for them. So it's really about them basically being willing to lend me their athlete, but also to lend me their relationship with that athlete. And that's huge. You know, we ask athletes for a lot of their feelings and their needs. And so you really only get that when you have a trust relationship built up. And that's one of the most important things that the athletic trainer provides us with, other than that they're out there in our community and doing great things for all the people in the community.
What's your number one tip for building patient trust? Is there something that you always make sure you do or that is always present when you meet someone for the first time or someone is sent to you from another colleague? What's your tip for building patient trust?
I think giving the patient or asking the patient for their story and making sure that I'm listening for and help direct the conversation to what is it that you're concerned about? What are you worried about? What can we do that would make you feel like your time here was successful and valuable to you? And making sure that that's not a one-time interaction. You know, a lot of people do that at the initial evaluation. But I think Laura and I both think that along the way, it is important to revisit that conversation and make sure that we're on the right track. And especially, you know, if you think about athletes, there is this transition time between acting and living in a safe environment and us then helping them go back to an uncontrolled environment that really involves that kind of relationship and is only successful if we have that.
Yeah, I 100% agree. It's creating sort of this, we're on matched, you know, matched expectation from the beginning. And I think it's really, especially with young athletes, helping them understand, like, we aren't the bad people, right? We're not here
to keep you out.
And I think that's a big barrier once an athlete sees you as an asset to their progression. It's a whole different relationship in their care. And not just for young athletes. I mean, I think the same goes for individuals of any age with a goal.
Yeah.
You know, my mom's coming off a bad ankle fracture a long time ago. She's been in and out of PT for 10 plus years now. And what keeps bringing her back to PT is the longevity, the concept that like the therapist is in it with her for the long haul. And she knows that that person, while her goals may have changed over time, are going to keep bringing her back. What is your goal? So to Ellen's point, I think we start that early, but we have to have that in our heads as we work with people over time.
The thing that brought her back to PT was the PT.
Yeah, it really was.
Right. And a lot of times
we're like, trust she has in that person.
Right. We can't necessarily rely on, or we shouldn't expect people to rely on, well, I came back because of the profession. That doesn't mean something different to a patient.
Right.
They have a relationship with a person, their PT. Right. Wouldn't it be great if we all had, oh, that's my PT. Yeah.
Yeah, it would be. If I could ask somebody who their PT was and the answer came as quick as who their doctor is.
Yeah.
Right.
You know.
How would we get there? It's been asked and no one's solved it yet. We're getting there.
Well, I think it is creating these relationships
sure.
with people and making sure that people understand that you're interested in their story and why they're here and where we're giving them what they want. You know, if I go to the store and I get stale bread, I'm not going back.
No.
But if I get the best bread I ever made a sandwich on, I'll probably go back.
And that's every time, which can seem overwhelming, right? Mm-hmm. But if you keep the focus simple, not easy, simple, on the person you're
right.
sitting, get the chance to sit across from, you got a better chance of churning out good loaves of bread, to mm-hmm. use your example.
Exactly.
You can't unlearn the fact that you have a psychology background. You know what I mean?
It's there.
So you have this curse of knowledge, right? But that's got to be a great tool because as much as you're formally trained in psychology, where does that get to pop in clinical practice, in research? That's got to be a pretty powerful tool.
Well, it's been a long time since I took those classes, we'll say that. But it is funny how I almost stumbled into that major in undergrad just because I didn't want to be a physics or chemistry major. And at the time, Duke didn't have any like pre-health kinesiology stuff. So turns out, I've brought those skills forward in my practice and my research off and on, I think, well, probably on constantly, whether I knew it or not. And I think it's kind of funny, Ellen and I were just talking, like now with some of the work I'm doing, I'm realizing that some of those approaches are probably as important, tapping into the person's psychology. And again, I'm not a psychologist. I'm a newbie in thinking about some of these concepts.
Sure.
But realizing that some of those themes, those needs that people have are as important as their physical impairments and finding ways to blend that. I think we do it naturally in clinical practice, and I was always around PTs who sort of got that intuitively and that's just kind of what they did, and I learned from that. But now thinking about how to do that more formally in research seems really important.
Yeah.
So it sort of feels like it was meant to be in some ways.
Yeah.
I'm glad I wasn't a physics major.
Yeah.
Psych was way more exciting to me. Yeah.
Well, so. I mean, I think it says a lot about the person, which is psychology is about people.
Right.
Physics is about the universe. Yeah. And I know people are in there, but psychology really focuses on that person.
Right.
What's the future hold after you guys learned from this and were able to build and grow and help people? Where do you think, where does your interest go after this? Or what are the next problems that need solving?
You know, that's a great question. I think Laura and I were just talking about, you know, the ways that we can continue to work together and continue to grow together. You know, we haven't necessarily solved the return to sport issue or the patients coming back again. So that's still, you know, a challenge. But I think, you know, I think we both agree that it's important to do something significant, not just successful.
Ooh.
To be able to leave a legacy of like how you work together to formulate a better future for not only patients but the professionals who treat them too. And so, I mean, that's what we hope to take from things like Laura's research, is to help our own clinicians have a better understanding and a better overall satisfaction with the job that they do when they work with a patient. And so that's a pretty lofty goal, I think.
Yeah, but you said significant, not just successful. I think that's a good one, right? Because if you hit your goal, but there's no significance in it,
then it's just we publish and put it on the table.
Yeah. Well, a lot of students walking around, they get very excited at these events as we record from CSM. What advice would you give for a student who maybe was where you were 5 to 10 years ago? Is there anything that you wish you knew then, what you know now?
I'm going to take that one. I mean, for me, it's sort of the cliche of like, don't close any doors and be okay if one door closes because, you know, you don't know what's around the corner. And I think for me, like, I mean, obviously I never thought I wanted to do research, so that's an obvious path. There were several research-oriented opportunities that did not work out for me. And I kept just following what my heart was saying in terms of passion, and what sort of was like the next best thing to do with my career.
Yeah.
And realizing that things I had done in the past weren't lost on me, but how could I continue to develop and always bring it back to like, what's the purpose of all this? So I think, you know, I teach students now, you know, as they're getting their DPT education, and the world is very big and yep. there's many, many opportunities. And sometimes you can't do everything at once. And so it's figuring out like, what do you want to do next? And yeah. then being okay with that changing in 5 years, 10 yeah. years, and being ready to just go for it. If it seems like it's the right time.
We sort of have to unteach that because we're sort of taught, you know, we go yeah. to eighth grade, then we go to yep. ninth grade, then you go to 10th grade and you do something and your goal is to do it for 25 years right. and then, you know, retire somewhere. It's like, well, it's sort of more fun when things zig and zag, mm-hmm. right? I feel like ATI is a pretty interesting place because there isn't just one. You saying make sure there's no doors closed. It feels like there's not even just one door.
No, I think that's right. You know, I never intended to stay in South Carolina for 15 years, and I've been there for 15 years now. There's a confluence of things that happen, but really what draws you to that is continually being able to find your why and continually having opportunities and relationships and the ability to change the environment you're in by impacting it in a great way. So I've had a lot of successful opportunities here, but they were made by the team, not by me.
Yeah, well, you say something interesting, too, is you sort of have to give yourself permission to change, because we tie a lot of our identity to, we started off by talking with athletes, and when you're injured, now you're an injured athlete. Are you an athlete anymore? You want to be. And if you're a clinician and you start doing this research thing, you have to sort of give yourself permission to say, I'm going to go this way. I'm going to take everything that I learned so far and bring it here.
Right.
So I think the more people hear, it doesn't just have to be linear. If I make a change, I'm allowed to do that. The ironic part is you're the only person who really needs to give yourself permission.
Right.
But you're also allowed to change back. You can really only speak for yourself, but I've been hesitant to change because if it doesn't work, what does that say about me?
Right.
And I think the more we can say that's sort of okay and you've still learned something in that.
You take something away from every experience,
correct.
You know. So a lot of times when a resident's coming to the end of their year there and they're trying to decide the next steps, we always talk about, you know, what some of your goals are and what's the worst thing that can happen
right.
if you choose something that doesn't work out. Well, the worst thing is that you've learned a lot.
Right.
And you have more capital from which to work from
yeah.
for the next decision.
Yeah.
So I think that's really important, understanding that, you know, it has to be important to you what you do. You know, it's what gives you satisfaction, what speaks to your why.
Seth Godin's a great writer. He calls it the dip. He's like, the dip in excitement is going to happen no matter what you do, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, find something you love, you'll never work a day in your life. I'm like, well, still going to work, right? And there
yeah.
can be the dip. And the only way you really go through the dip is if you really, really care about it. So you just made me think of a question I would love to know. What's something like, how do you know if someone's going to be a good resident? What are things that you look for to say, yeah, this is going to match up? This is someone, and it's going to kind of be global because it's going to be different for everybody. But what's a characteristic or two that you think you can spot to say, yeah, this is right for this person? Or I should say, this person is right for this situation.
You know, that's an interesting question because I get that a lot from other people that we interview with and talk to residents, or people that are prospective residents. And I think it's being able to get into a meaningful conversation with them so that you can really gauge whether their goals are aligned with our goals. And, you know, we always say to people during the residency process that we want them to ensure that it's the right thing for them, as well as us ensuring that they're the right person for the position. Because it's a lot of work over
sure.
a year. you know, and you have to be extremely passionate about it. You don't always have to have the highest energy, but you have to have the highest commitment to it. And so I think, you know, we've made a lot of good hires and good residents from that process. So it's worked pretty well for us. And I think, you know, peer pressure is also a wonderful thing. You know, we take a bunch of residents at once, and they really learn to work as a team. And that peer pressure really, really changes the expectations of each individual. It's almost like being on a team and everybody accepting their role and being willing to do that role.
Should you do it again?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. I mean... And
we would take her again, all right, too, just for the record.
Good.
It was probably one of the best years of my life. I mean, certainly of my career, but really of just life in general. And I think where I sit now, I mentor a lot of students pursuing residency, and they always ask me, and they know I did a residency, you know, what does it take? What do I need to be? What's the right fit for this program? And I think everything Ellen said, I think there's also... what makes a good resident is someone who is okay with stepping outside their comfort zone and just going for it in a way, and realizing that it they're going to be in a situation that's going to be hard, but they're just a sponge and ready to learn. And again, I think that's sort of goes without saying, but it's an intense year, and I think the people that really want to do it for the right reason and they're willing to push themselves into those domains and step out of those their comfort zone are going to have a really successful year. And it could look different for everyone,
yeah.
What that year kind of transpires to be. Mm-hmm. But kind of a willingness to be scared almost, right? Yeah. To just like be in the moment and learn.
I heard a great quote, which is acting brave in the face of fear is bravery. That's it.
Yeah.
It's, we get scared. My dad was a fireman. I remember being a kid and saying, like, when do you stop being scared of running into a burning building? It's like, we're always scared. Just doing it anyway.
Yeah.
So it's looking at that and saying, I don't know. If I want to become that, this is a way. And if this one I think is right for me, doing it anyway.
Right.
And what's the worst that happens? You learn some stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, they have a lot of fun along the way, too.
Hopefully,
and we
yeah.
have a lot of fun along the way, too.
Good.
So, yeah. So it's a great partnership.
Last thing we do on each episode is something called the parting shot. Did they prepare you for this?
No.
Parting shots is like, what's your soapbox statement, your mic drop moment, can be about something we talked about today or not at all. What's something if you were like going to put on a business card and make sure you hand it out, something like here at CSM, what's something you'd always want the profession to think about or know?
Well, you know, what runs through my mind right away is make every life an active life, because that's our new slogan. I was part of that team, and it super jazzed me up when we
yeah.
came up with that slogan. But I think the one ATI or the collaboration between physical therapy and other health professionals and the patient is the most important thing, and making sure that you create a team for each patient that you see is really important. But don't forget that making every life an active life is a great slogan.
That's well done. What's your parting shot, Laura? What do you got?
I think, I mean, just generally, I think just this concept of just go for it. And I mean that from like as a student, as a clinician, as you pursue your own kind of professional goals, is just go for it and don't be afraid. And for patients too, like go for it in terms of what their goals are.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of concept sort of transcends whoever it is as a part of this continuum. But I think we have, whether you're a clinician, a patient, a researcher, or some blend of all of those things, I think we have a chance to just improve how we are, improve our health, improve our goals, and just not be afraid to fail. I think I've come back to that a lot when I feel like I'm going to get my type A moment. Just be okay with failure, because
yeah.
you're going to grow from it.
Yeah.
And so that would be my parting shot.
Well said. Thanks so much for doing what you do and stopping by and telling us about it so that message spreads, because we don't want you to hide what you figured out so the rest of us can benefit from it.
Well, I appreciate your time.
Yeah,
it was
for
great
us.
Fun.
The PT Pinecast is a product of PT Pinecast LLC. It is hosted and produced by PT Pinecast CEO Jim McKay and CBO Sky Donovan from Marymount University. We talk PT, drink beer, and record it. This has been another pour from the PT Pinecast. The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. More on the show at ptpinecast.com.